Good evening, everybody. Welcome to Rose City Politics. It is November the 17th. That is a hard one for me to just wrap my head around. It was just January. But our regular panel tonight includes myself, John Lidke, and we also have Doug Sartori. Doug coming to us without a green screen, or you've got a green screen. You've just opted for really boring background.
No, this is coming to you from Parallel 42's orbiting world headquarters. So tonight we're in a different venue.
There you go. I'm coming to you not with a green screen either. I'm just in the past at the old Windsor City Hall. I'm sorry. This was such a gorgeous building. It was beautiful. I don't know why they couldn't have kept the middle part at least. Anyways, I don't want to get off track. If you're listening though tonight and you're not a Patreon subscriber, head over to patreon.com/RoseCityPolitics. We would appreciate you signing up there. We are in BizX Magazine. We're at bizxmagazine.com on all of your favorite social media apps and your podcasting apps. And Rose City Politics has been able to broadcast live on tape thanks to the kind support of Luna 625 Building Better Communities. We have a very fun show tonight. We've got a special guest who I'm going to be introducing in just a moment. But before we get to that, you're able to see, though, if you're watching the YouTube right now, you can use your eyes and you can see that we have a special guest. You could read who it is. But if you're listening, we're going to keep the suspense going. We do, though, as I said, we've got some great topics tonight. We're going to be discussing Windsor's most dangerous intersections, the new Windsor Regional Hospital survey. In quotation marks. Is it a survey if there's only one question?
We'll get to that. I actually asked an expert that question, so remind me.
Oh, looking forward to hearing that, because I looked it up as well, but I don't think that you can just take the first Google result as a actual reasonable answer on it. We have the vaccine mandate now in effect at the city of Windsor. We're going to be talking about how that has played out across the corporation and its divisions. And last but not least, we've got a video clip from Ward 1 Councillor Fred Francis. And he's talking about one of our favorite topics that we have on this show, Roseland Golf and Curling Club and the clubhouse and their, you know, their profit loss statements. It's, you know, it's the sexiest topic that there is in municipal politics. So we are going to get to all of that. But before we do, we have a special guest tonight who is joining us as a co-host as well throughout this entire episode. We are so glad to have Kenia Rezagian. How are you, Kenia?
Hello, John. Hi, Doug. I'm good. I'm happy to be here. I'm excited to be invited on the show. I've been a fan of it for a while. I told Doug when we first met that this really was my way to learn about municipal politics in Windsor when I was just starting to dig in. So I'm happy to be on the other side of the podcast or the YouTube video now.
That is awesome. You are, I guess, one of the really special ones because this is like such an inside baseball podcast to get into, not just like what's going on in the city, but like, you know, the really inane stuff that only, you know, real nerds of municipal politics like to dive into. But we are so glad that we were able to serve that role for you. We're psyched to have you here. I said psyched. I don't know. I guess it's 2007, but you know, feeling good about it. You've got listed, you know, you're a community builder, facilitator, justice, equity, and public policy. You're a former student trustee. Tell me just a bit about yourself. You know, give me the elevator pitch. Let the audience know, who are you? What's it all about that you do?
Oh boy, that's a tough one. I do many things. As you can see, reading my brief bio, I try and squish as many words as I can into there. Because really, I just am motivated by building equitable and healthy and happy and fun community spaces and filling whatever role I can to meet that end. So right now I'm doing a little bit of work on climate justice and environmental organizing. I'm working with an organization called Green Pack on advancing environmental leadership in politics. And also doing some justice and equity training with different organizations. So that's what I'm occupied with right now, but generally just thinking about how to engage people who are typically not engaged by political decision making and build policy and build community spaces that are inclusive and joyful and equitable to everybody. So that's my little elevator pitch of what I do.
Well, it's a good one. Thank you for that. I'm sure the audience appreciates that. So, you know, you're interested in climate issues. You know, I don't think I need to ask why at this point. I think that question's been answered a lot over the past couple of years. Why would anyone be interested in, you know, how, you know, the climate is changing? We're seeing it on a rapid basis right now in Canada, especially on the West Coast. We're seeing, you know, tremendous impacts. I don't think anyone could argue against that. So, you know, I'll throw a quick question to you. This is what the show is all about, is, you know, trying to figure out what people's views about things are and how it relates to where we live in the city where we live. What do you think, you know, can and should municipalities be doing about climate change adaption? We know that last night the school board approved a declaration of a climate emergency, which is, you know, it's a meaningful step forward. What needs to be done at that municipal level? I know that you have had a specific background in this, so I guess, you know, looking for, you know, not necessarily the catch up, but you know, what needs to be done?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And there's actually a lot that municipalities can do. I think when we talk about climate change, a lot of people feel scared and intimidated that it's this huge international, this huge national issue that is out of a lot of our control. However, municipalities in Canada, at least, are responsible for transportation, for building codes and land management. And these are huge climate issues. So transportation is one of the largest greenhouse gas emitting causes. And so thinking about how we move around, how we commute, is a big thing that municipalities can focus on. So I've really loved seeing the work of Activate Transit Windsor Essex. And I was just speaking with Jess the other day about this article where we need to at least double public transit use if we want to meet our climate commitments and targets in Canada and also around the world. So we need to rethink how we exist in communities. And to do that, that happens at the municipality. So here in Windsor, you know, we're really built around commuting by car. It's not necessarily accessible to commute as a pedestrian or as a cyclist. We're going to get into that, I'm sure, as well when we talk about road safety. However, public transit, that's a big piece we can rethink about when we're thinking about how to reorganize our communities to be safe in the future. So transit is just one piece, but land use, you know, thinking about densifying and keeping communities close so that we don't have to travel long distances to get to where we need to go. That's another big thing that is in the hands of municipalities, and protecting the nature that we have left. So much of nature has been destroyed for development because for so many years we thought more development is good. The more development we have, the better and more economically thriving our cities are. However, the loss of nature is causing tremendous damage to the environment, to the climate. You talked about the BC floods, and old growth logging in BC is one of the drivers of the immense flooding and the wildfires that we've been seeing. So that's a little grim and a little dark. However, there's a lot that municipalities can be doing. And it's exciting that the school board had this climate emergency declaration. I think it shows a real care and interest for the students within the school board and for youth in general. And as well to celebrate the 2-year declaration from the city of Windsor of the climate emergency.
Do you think that, well, you know, first I should mention the motion was by Trustee Sipkar, who brought that forward. But do you think that locating a mega hospital in a soybean field in the outskirts of the city is a, you know, is that following the principles of, you know, following a declaring a climate emergency? Is this what, you know, should be done right now?
No, I don't think it follows the principles of a climate emergency. I actually, you know, I wasn't in Windsor for the majority of kind of the decision-making process around the mega hospital, and really learned about it when I moved back after the pandemic started. Talking to my dad, I saw this one of those lawn signs of "we need the mega hospital now." I didn't know about the project. I asked my dad about it. And he said he's been a cab driver for 30 years in Windsor. And he's like, yeah, it's this project, that, you know, I've never heard a single person be for it in my 30 years of driving a cab. You know, all of these people are so concerned. So I can't speak so much to the engagement and kind of the decision making around this project. However, when I think about climate and when I think about the environment, like that is exactly counter to dense land use planning, to protecting green natural spaces that we have, not even considering the equity pieces. So no, I think, you know, if that was a decision that was made prior to having all of these considerations and seeing the severity of the climate crisis, I think now that we see that severity and now that we understand it, it isn't reconcilable with a city's climate emergency declaration. And if we're to move forward, we have to accept that it's hypocritical to have that emergency declaration and also be acting exactly counter to it.
So okay. It's interesting.
I like that, hypocritical.
Yeah, it's interesting because at one of the recent ward meetings, and I don't recall which one, but I did see the question and answer posted online, and I want to just throw it out there for discussion because someone asked a question in a very similar vein to Mayor Dilkins. And the question that was asked was not about the mega hospital, but relating to the Sandwich Southlands, which are open to development because of the mega hospital location. And so Mayor Dilkins was asked, you know, basically, why are you committing the city to sprawl? And his response, Mayor Dilkins' response, and I'm paraphrasing, I don't have the quote in front of me, was basically, we need to build this because the demand for single family homes is not going away in our region. And if we don't build it, then we'll have worse sprawl, or the real sprawl, which is people living in Essex, Lakeshore, Amherstburg, et cetera. So I thought that was an interesting way to sort of frame it as better sprawl. And Kimia, I'm curious what your thoughts are there.
For me, it goes back to rethinking the ways we live in a community. I think if we're going to continue to think that as population grows, the more people we have, everyone needs their, you know, a single family housing unit, perhaps there's some credibility there. But when we think about sustainability in the future, we can't be living in the same way that we do. We have to rethink the scale at which we're living, the space that we take up. When we think about densification, we might have to live in smaller communities and in smaller spaces. Sprawl in the long run is not going to, if it's going to be destroyed from climate disasters, we're not going to have that space to mitigate the impacts of climate change that are to come. And also another big issue about developing on prime agricultural land is climate change exacerbates food insecurity. And so as food pressures rise, we need all the agricultural land and space we can have to make sure that people stay fed. And so, you know, that's an argument, but I don't think it's an adequate one when you weigh it against the scale of the climate crisis that we're facing. So I think it goes back to thinking of creative solutions about how do we live in community, what's an acceptable way to do so. And I think that requires a big culture shift. I don't think that's an answer a lot of people want to hear. People want big homes and big backyards. But people also want to survive for the next 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 years and for the future generations of their children to survive. And if we look at what's happening in British Columbia right now, you know, if that's a fate that we're looking towards, what does it matter if we develop in that area and then all of that land is, and those homes and developments are destroyed anyway, instead of rethinking what we can do in more densely populated areas and protecting the lands that we have.
Yeah, I'm going to still focus on that hypocritical point that you made because, you know, it is what it is. And, you know, the cynic in me has to focus on it because I don't want to let people get points for doing the absolute least that you can to try to prove that you're doing some kind of Herculean monumental feat when, you know, we can all see it. You know, there's nothing wrong with, well, no, there is. There is lots wrong with what I'm going to say. But just at least be honest if what you want to do is, you know, encroach onto lands because you want to have significant development because it will yield A, B, or C, or we're being extorted by community X, Y, or Z, and we have to respond in such a way, you know, just own it. But trying to play this game, you know, it's frustrating. It's hypocritical. That's the point. We'll leave it at that. But let's go on to a much more fun topic than climate change. And we'll start talking about the worst intersections that have been ranked in Windsor, and the dangers that come from them. Windsor Star's Brian Cross put this one out. The westbound on-ramp to the EC Row Expressway at Central and Walker Road ranked number 1 and 2 for intersections with the highest number of fatal or serious injuries in the city. This is from a report that ranked the city's worst intersections, all intersections, I suppose, but they, you know, compiled the worst ones. And it's from between 2015 to 19. The data is used by the city's traffic engineering department to analyze changes needed to reach for the goal of Vision Zero, which was set by City Council 2 years ago, trying to achieve zero fatalities and serious injuries on city roads. So there were some significant findings in the report, and I'm going to break these up and we're going to talk about them as we go through. I think first off, though, if you're listening, you're going to want to know where are the worst areas. So EC Row Expressway from Howard to Walker, that was number 1 for fatal and serious injury accidents at non-intersections. EC Row from Lauzon Parkway to Banwell tied for number 2. There were also 2 segments of County Road 42 and 2 segments of Tecumseh Road as well. Tecumseh Road East and Forest Glade Drive, that had 97 crashes from 2015 to 19. Wyandotte Street West at Polisher, County Road 42 at Lauzon, Lauzon Parkway at Forest Glade Drive, Olette Place and Dougal Avenue, Howard Avenue and South Cameron Boulevard, and finally, Norfolk Street and Dominion Boulevard. Avoid those. You are in danger if you use any of those major intersections as per the City of Windsor Traffic and Planning. That's what they say, not me. They were the one who put this report together. I didn't. But let's talk about some findings here that are outside of just the intersections themselves. Motor vehicle collision fatality rate. Windsor has a rate of 2.45 per 100,000 versus a provincial rate of 3.95, which is, you know, arguably good. We're less than the provincial rate. But then you look at the injury rate and we're at 7.91 per 1,000 versus the Ontario rate of 3.19. Doug, when we first were looking this over, that was the first stat that you and I both sort of red flagged there. What's your take? I don't think you're going to say it's a good number. I can presume where you're coming from, but I mean, what do you see when you see something that's as staggering as the injury rate being more than double that of the province down here?
Yeah. So reading from these statistics, it sounds like, it looks to me like we have a lower fatality rate, but a higher injury rate. What I'd be curious about, and I didn't see it when I was skimming through the report, I'd be curious about our absolute numbers of road accidents compared to other areas of Ontario. And it is good, I suppose, that we have a lower fatality rate than the provincial rate. But in general, like what's interesting to me is actually some of the information that you're going to get into shortly. But what is interesting to me here, you rattle off that list of dangerous stretches of road and intersections. And I don't think that anyone who drives regularly in Windsor is going to be particularly surprised by any of the entries on that list, particularly EC Row between Howard and Walker Road. That is terrifying. And it got me to thinking about the level of risk that we accept when we get behind the wheel of a vehicle. And there is a trade-off. You're accepting a fairly significant personal risk in exchange for the convenience and freedom of being able to operate a vehicle. And everyone gets to make their own decision about, you know, how they want to manage that risk and whether they think that's a fair risk for them in their lives. But I want to use that as a segue for you to get into the next bit of statistics, which is to talk about some of the people who are taking risks that don't necessarily accept them or, you know, benefit from that trade-off. You know, if you're a pedestrian, there is no benefit to you for, you know, driver A to be getting to their destination conveniently and quickly. That is just a pure risk for a pedestrian with no offsetting benefit. And that's where I think the numbers are surprising and staggering. So I'm going to let you get to them.
Yeah. And I'll bring you in, Kenia, to respond to these statistics here. But I do want to address just really quickly there, Doug, what you said about that section on EC Row between Howard and Walker. Like, that is like white knuckle driving, even when you are a good driver after experience. And I remember, you know, going for the driving test and you're doing driver's ed on that area. And just the expressway itself, like, people that aren't from Windsor really can't appreciate how insane the expressway is, because every 40 seconds there is another on-ramp, off-ramp situation that is the kind that you just can't, you would never see anywhere else in a modern civilized society. Two lanes, and one of them is the one that they're shooting onto and you're shooting off of, negotiating. And, you know, it usually works, but of course, you know, as is noted here in the numbers, it doesn't, because it's the number one for, you know, fatalities. And that's a problem there. But let's talk about this, Kenia. I want to go into this. This is where you're coming from, you know, the lens of equity and accessibility in this sphere. Vulnerable road users, now that's defined as cyclists, motorcyclists, and pedestrians, accounted for, and like, I had to read back on this, 46% of fatalities and major injuries. And, you know, I guess on face value, you would presume maybe that to be the case because, you know, they're not protected, right? You're not in a vehicle. You don't have four walls around you. It's not an SUV. What it shows with that number, though, I mean, I would only presume, is that the infrastructure isn't there for what it needs to be. Now, cyclists made up 9% of those injuries and fatalities, pedestrians 20%, and motorcyclists 16%. And, you know, it's not a fight between either of those three groups for which is, you know, the most seriously impacted. If Don were here, he would say, it's awful for motorcyclists. I'd say it's terrible for cyclists. I was in a car accident with a car. I'm sure one of you would both say, you know, being a pedestrian is tough enough. The point being is there's no race or award to say I'm the most severely impacted by the poor infrastructure decisions that we have. What's your take on that, Kenia, these numbers? 46%.
Yeah, John, I was also blown away by that. I also reread it. And when I was reading about this, I wrote this down so that I wouldn't forget. Pedestrians, cyclists, and motorcyclists, it also included, were only involved in about 5% of the collisions, but they made up almost half of the fatalities and injuries. Like, that's an astronomical number, and that's not acceptable and not a burden that we can put on pedestrians, cyclists, motorcyclists. And I think, again, that goes back to rethinking being in a car-centered city and a city that prioritizes auto commuting and travel above all. Doug, you were speaking to, you know, the risks you take when you step into your car and decide you're going to drive and what that comes with. But some, like, as a pedestrian, as a cyclist, you might not have the option to step into a car, which, as we see in this report, is a safer option perhaps than walking or taking your bike. I was a student for 5-6 years in Ottawa. I didn't have a car. I relied on walking and riding my bike everywhere. It's low income people, it's students, it's people with, you know, less access to vehicles who are most impacted by these accidents and by injuries and fatalities. So I think it again asks us to think about, you know, when we're talking about new roads or road expansion, are we only thinking about cars that are going to commute there, or are we also structurally thinking about different types of commuters, cyclists, pedestrians, and making sure that those spaces are safe for them as well. Because if they're not, people are going to end up as the, you know, on the bad side of this.
The city has a pretty mixed record on this. On the positive side, I do want to point out that the tunnel on Dougal Avenue that basically eliminated what was long known as the Dougal death trap. That was a major piece of engineering, a major piece of work in the city that was undertaken the last few years and did a lot for cyclist and pedestrian safety. So there are things that are being done, but at the same time, the tenor, at least in my opinion, the tenor of the approach to how we construct our roadways, how we maintain our roadways, and how we make decisions about roadways is driven by exactly what you said, Kimia, and that's driver convenience and optimizing for fast commutes. What would the infrastructure in our city look like if we optimized for pedestrian safety, cyclist safety? I'm not so worried about the motorcyclists, sorry, Don, but what would it look like if we took those two things, pedestrian and cyclist safety, as seriously as we could? How many resources would we have to divert from road construction and road maintenance to have separated bike lanes throughout the city? How much would we have to divert from those road construction funds in order to have sidewalks in every area of the city? There are a lot of places in this city, a lot of places that are important routes for foot commuters, like neighborhood to school connections, that don't have adequate sidewalks. Why is this not a priority? When people feel like traffic is bad in a particular location, when people feel that their drive times are being extended because of limited infrastructure, the city takes action. Cabana Road is under construction right now. It's being widened to 4 lanes. This is a major and huge investment of municipal resources towards driver convenience and improving the speed of road transportation. Cabana Road is not going to have separated bike lanes. And, and that's a choice. That's a choice that was made in very recent memory. So, I go back to my initial statement. I think the record is mixed, but I just don't get the sense that that pedestrian and cyclist safety are a top priority. And I think this report for that reason was really refreshing, and having a Vision Zero initiative is really refreshing, because it's hopefully a change in that approach and a change in policy. And it may take a while for it to fully be articulated, but hopefully it means that we will start redirecting resources to where they're needed.
Yeah, I think we know why things are the way they've been. The automotive capital of Canada. Car access has been huge. The car has ruled the city socioeconomically in Windsor. Who's more likely to be a reliable voter? Someone who's driving a car or someone who is walking or using the bus? I think in Windsor, you look through it historically, a lot of politicians would have made the vote, or the bet rather, that it's a more reliable vote from the car driver rather than the bus user, because still in Windsor, I'll say this, it might not be, nice to be heard, but I think that the view is still among most in the city, the unemployed or the poor are the ones who use Transit Windsor. And I think our priorities that we're seeing are reflected through that. And the numbers, I think, demonstrate that intolerance to what is rapidly, increasingly becoming, a significant means of transportation. I don't want to be sitting here trying to sell active transit or alternative transportation. It's well known, but it's our politics, and for better or for worse, we're cursed with it, but it's great to, see this coming forward. My concern, Doug, respond to this. You think that we're just going to end up seeing the goal of Vision Zero, figure out what we're going to do, but then just shelve it?
Well, I think that's always a risk, and the antidote is comes back to exactly the reverse of what you were saying. Motorists are seen as reliable voters. I think that's true, that that councillors, when they think about who are the people that elected me, they're probably thinking about a car commuter. That's probably true. But not only that, and we talk a lot about diversity on council, and maybe one of the things that we don't talk about quite as much as other elements of diversity is the diversity of perspectives and socioeconomic backgrounds. How many councillors rely on public transportation? Very few would be my educated guess on that matter. So I think that the answer and the antidote is that folks who rely on alternate forms of transportation, or who would like to rely on alternate forms of transportation to get around their city, have to be vocal. They have to be active. If you are a person who cares a lot about these issues and wants to see a change in the transportation policy, volunteer for a municipal campaign, volunteer for a ward campaign, and tell that candidate why you're doing it. Believe it or not, those type of gestures have a big impact and can give you a good opportunity to share your views with a candidate who aligns with yours and who you believe in. So, you know, I think that stuff like Activate Transit are a good step in that direction, trying to get folks together and organize folks who have, a different perspective or represent a different interest group than the easy one that we've talked about, that, you know, suburban dwelling car commuter.
Yeah, you know, can't disagree with you on that. I think if you're looking to see a different type of system, you know, if you're the type of person that thinks that we should replace all of our sidewalks and bike lanes and roadways with just dedicated motorcycle lanes, Don Merrifield would love to have you working on his campaign. I hear that he's going to be running on a very, very social platform of motorcycles for all and only motorcycle lanes. But Kenia, let's give you one last response here to this topic before we move on to the next one.
Yeah, I think I agree and appreciate what Doug said. I think also, you know, it's also kind of council's responsibility and the people who are responsible for kind of making these decisions to reach people who aren't being represented and who aren't part of, because when you are a single mom who relies on public transit and just needs to get food on the table for your kids and get your kids to and from school, you aren't listening to Rose City politics and you aren't thinking, I need to write this letter to my counselor to express this. You might not even know who your counselor is, have the language skills. You know, there's so many barriers to access municipal politics, and that's the problem of our institution. That isn't the problem of the public not engaging with the institution. And so I think if we really want to show that, and I think unfortunately the case is that we don't often care about democracy and we don't often care about equity, but if we want to show that we do, it's our institutions and systems' responsibility to reach people where they're at and to pull people into these decision-making processes. I think the city budget engagement tool was a cool way to start doing that. I think there's still lots of barriers there too that can be talked about, but starting to think of creative ways to reach people who aren't traditionally and historically reached, not to a fault of their own, but because structures haven't had the interest in engaging them because of these generalizations. You named, John, like, these aren't voters and these aren't people who are going to benefit me in the long run. So why would I engage with this community?
You know, it's engagement with the community, consultation with the community. That's one of the hot buttons that I always hammer on here. I think maybe a bit too strongly, but then I immediately realize, no, why am I being nice to them? It's their job. You literally have one job. And I don't think the city does a great job when it comes to engagement, generally speaking. I think that a lot of our institutions that we deal with, you could hope for them to be better in terms of how they engage. A lot of it feels like, you know, we say this on the show often, it's the bare minimum. We've got the checklist of what is mandated in terms of engagement, And as long as we can defend that we've done it to an extent, we can actually get on to when, you know, the grownups are sitting around a table and we don't need to listen to the riffraff that's out there making noise, and we'll deliver them what it is they know that they don't know they need it, but we'll give it to them. But let's talk, that might be a little bit of a harsh segue into this from what was a very nice segue. I took it to a very negative place, but let's keep it, I suppose. Have your say, Windsor Regional Hospital survey. Ah, that rhymes, and I didn't realize it when I was reading it in my head. Doug is not happy with that one. Windsor Regional Hospital is asking for area residents to complete a survey about the stage two planning process and design principles to guide the mega hospital process moving forward. The design principles are a set of agreed upon values that will guide the planning team throughout the design process. The principles are established by the hospital executive committee with input from hospital staff, professional staff, users, and the community. Throughout the project, they keep the team focused on a shared set of criteria and guide for decision making. Now, David Mucci, CEO of Windsor Regional Hospital, says they want to, quote, integrate the community's vision right from the beginning, starting with the design principles. I guess this is the beginning. I was told that the beginning of the public consultation, Doug, happened, you know, over the past number of years. But now we're at the beginning when we're at stage two. I don't know, that just stands out just at the very least for me. Interesting, though, the survey consists of one question. Is it a survey? If it's just one question, we'll get to that. It asks, what are your top priorities for the new Windsor Essex Acute Care Hospital design and why? So, you know, very limited in scope there. They want to know about the design and why. That's really all it's about. I guess they weren't, I don't know, do they not have the funds maybe to upgrade to the paid version of SurveyMonkey, Doug? Just the one question free version? Like, we don't want to splurge the budget. I mean, we got $10 million from the province here. We got to hire at least a couple architects and engineers to render it. So we can't go splurging on survey software.
Yeah, that could be it. That money got to make it last. It's been a while since they saw any money for this project, so maybe they are being frugal. All kidding around aside, though, so the technical answer is that yes, it counts as a survey, even if it's only one question. It does not count as a questionnaire. I think it's a different question as to whether it's a good survey or whether this is a good start for this consultation process. Back in March of this year, when the funding was first announced for stage two at the budget time, I wrote for BizX about that stage two funding and the consultation process. And what I hoped we would see was a change in tone and a change in direction from Windsor Regional Hospital. This stage two consultation represents an opportunity to reset a discussion that has been characterized, I think, by a lot of bitterness, by not a lot of, listening, more a lot of yelling past each other by various proponents, I think. And there was an opportunity here to reset. And even more importantly, I think, and to some of the things that Kimia was talking about earlier, an opportunity to do more in a consultation than allow interested people to opt in, an opportunity to go out to the community and find out what people need from a hospital, what people want from a hospital, to really dig into the community, take a representative sample, which means that opting in is not an option. You have to go and find people where they live and engage with them in a way that is going to make sense with them in order to elicit the answers that you truly need to design a healthcare system for everyone. So I don't think that they're succeeding with this first foray, and it's not a very good start. And I think the main reason for that, look, asking one open-ended question is not the greatest crime against consultation that I've ever seen. To me, where it fails is in context. In the context of a debate that is divisive and bitter, in the context of an initial consultation process that was poor, and that left, I think, significant divisions in the community, I really believe that it was the onus was on Windsor Regional Hospital to show the community that things are different, that they want to do things differently, and that they care about having a sincere opportunity for public input. And I saw the response online, and it was what you'd expect, I guess. Skeptics are continue to be skeptical, but the hospital did not seem to do anything to reach out and reduce that skepticism. You know, it's really easy to look at this question, asking a very complex and open-ended question with no real background in the questionnaire, no context provided, makes it real easy to do whatever you want with whatever responses you get. And I just don't think that Windsor Regional Hospital has built the trust through this process to give them the benefit of the doubt that they are going to make good and thoughtful use of the responses that they get. So for those reasons, I think that this is a really poor start, and I hope for better in the future.
Yeah, everything you shared there, Doug, resonates. But, and I think what you're speaking to, the lack of context, even on the form itself, I think everybody's learning about public engagement. I don't think this is just a Windsor issue. All of the spaces I've been in, I think all of the policy, economic spaces I've been in, people's eyes and worlds are recently being opened to, oh, we need to receive the input of people who are actually impacted by these decisions before we make them. Oh, we're not actually the only experts just because, you know, we have university degrees and have been doing this for years. Maybe the people who are impacted these decisions are the experts and should be the architects of the decisions that impact them. So I don't think this is an exclusive Windsor issue in terms of like not knowing how adequate public engagement works. But another concern, two concerns I have. One, I'm not sure, does this just exist online? Is this just one question on the internet that maybe you see if you saw the mayor tweet it out? And if not, you know, who is this reaching? Are we going door to door? Are we offering this as a written option for patients who are coming into the hospital, who are going into the cancer center? Are we asking caregivers, the people who are impacted by these decisions? If it's just a question on the internet, I don't think we're reaching a representative sample. So that's one concern I have. But perhaps, you know, we are. Perhaps people are going through different avenues and there are other ways that this question is being circulated. And another thing is, I'm not sure how this is incorporated in the decision-making process. There's this survey and a question, but as somebody who's completing the survey, I'm not told how my input is going to be considered. And so, you know, a lot of public engagement that I've seen, especially I work in youth engagement. I've been doing youth-based engagement for years. And a big issue that I've constantly run into and that other young people raise the alarm about is every government, every group wants to seek the input of youth, but it's completely extractive and there's no way that input is actually incorporated into the decision-making. It's like you mentioned at the beginning, John, a check mark that we've ticked off. We did engagement, but there was no clear communication. And that's frustrating if you're giving your heart and you're giving your energy towards like, this is what I care about in my community. And it's not even being considered. So if the question isn't in good faith, it feels wrong to even pose it. So these are not, you know, I don't mean any of this as accusatory because perhaps the hospital is reaching people where they're at and does have an honest way to integrate this feedback. But I don't see that by just clicking on the link. And that might be a good thing to communicate to somebody who's filling the survey.
You know, I think a good way to tell if it's a good faith survey or a bad faith survey will be to look at the results of the survey. And if they only release, you know, a media statement that says, you know, 78% of people said they wanted it to look pretty and 25% said that they were concerned about it, you know, not meeting that, like if they don't show you like the full spectrum of responses and it's cherry picked, I think, you know, it goes to prove what the cynicism that at least runs through me continues to feel with one of these things.
I think you can make a pretty safe bet that there are word clouds in your future on this one. you know, that would be my guess. as to what we're going to get back is some kind of a word cloud. I agree with you. I think it would be really interesting to see what the responses actually are in their full text. I very much doubt that we're going to get that. And then that goes back to the point I was making about trust. I just don't think that a cross-section, the broad cross-section of the community has the trust in Windsor Regional Hospital for them to get away with a weaker process. And Kimia, your points are well taken. We don't know all of the ways that this is being communicated or how, but again, in an environment where the trust is not there and where you have had two warring camps be the most prominent voices on this issue for years and years and years, I think it's incumbent on Windsor Regional Hospital to do a little bit better and both show us and tell us how things are going to be different this time.
Yeah, and you know, we've seen like already, Doug, a bit of a smarmy response out of the mayor's office on this one, and then we'll move on. The mayor said that the we're on stage two process, shared the survey, and there was a comment from someone who isn't even against the hospital project, very much in support of it, says you'd think with all the setbacks getting it approved, there's been plenty of time to get this part done. We should already have had plans ready to go. And the mayor's office responds, the setbacks, in quotation marks, involved getting the $10 million in funding to undertake the work required in this phase. So, you know, a very, very smarmy response. And I know that the mayor's office obviously doesn't have anything to do with Windsor Regional Hospital, except for the fact that they seem to coordinate a lot of their messaging there. So, you know, it's already on the outset of this survey. The tone, at least in my opinion and observation, it's not the best start. But you know, I'm not gonna be negative about it. I'm gonna keep a open faith and hope that we end up with the best process ever.
That sounds like naysayer talk to me, John.
Yeah, it feels like it too. Let's go on though. We're keeping this as a rapid fire show. Vaccine compliance has hit 91% at the City of Windsor. But the mandate has forced Transit Windsor to reduce service. So at the City of Windsor, the CAO, Jason Raynor, said he's thrilled 91% of the corporation's workforce has been vaccinated as of Monday, whereas last week they were at 78%. Roughly 200 people, or just 7% of the 3,000 workforce, have not disclosed their vaccination status and have been placed on unpaid leave. Operations at City Hall are moving along well, and other operations, including fire and rescue services, are being able to manage with reduced staffing levels. Last week, there were, quote, quite a few firefighters who had not confirmed their full vaccination status, but now there's only 4.5% who are unvaccinated or undeclared. The deadline for Windsor Police is the 26th for the 700 employees there. Now, the 91% vaccination compliance across the corporation includes a 2% compliance rate that was given for exemptions for medical or human rights reasons. And of the 200 going on unpaid leave, there are what have been recognized as a number of part-timers. Lifeguards specifically was noted as they had already worked during the summer and they're not going to be coming back necessarily. So it makes sense that there would actually be, you know, some holdovers there because they're not quite technically employed, even though they're on the books. So 91% compliance, I think that's, you know, pretty impressive overall. Transit Windsor, though, as I said, they've moved to an enhanced Saturday service due to what has been quoted as a significant staffing shortage. Now, it's challenging with scheduling. Some of the problems that they indicated were in their mechanical division in terms of people who were able to actually repair buses, apparently, are some of the unvaccinated. So it's causing some issues there. But, you know, they're going to work their way through it. And the mayor has already been quoted to the media saying that after 13 more weeks of this situation, we are moving towards what he said a vaccinate or terminate situation would be applied. Most interesting, Windsor Public Library, 100% compliance rate. So way to go, librarians. Way to go, library support staff. I am really right now leaning out to, like, you know, I think 2 to 3 people that we've had on the show in the past before, really reaching for that library fan base that we have. But it's a great number, 100%. That's great. That is, it's wonderful.
Totally no surprise that library people are at 100% vaccination rate. The thing about librarians is that their job is to know how to know things. So it's not surprising that, you know, they have reached 100% compliance and are making the optimal choice there. Just giving a little boost to our librarian related fandom.
Yeah, libraries are definitely the way of the future. I think we all need to follow their lead.
You can have so much fun with a library card.
It's true. So this is a really tough topic. There's a lot of stuff going on here. When Windsor Regional Hospital and Hotel Dew mandated basically be vaccinated or be let go, that made sense to me. It makes sense to me that healthcare workers need to set an example, that they need to provide a safe place and a safe environment, and having their own vaccinations is part of doing that. And I understand the policy when it comes to police. Many, many people do not have an option about whether they are going to interact with a police officer or not. And I think it's reasonable that if you are going to engage in non-optional interactions with the public, that you should be taking the basic public health precautions like being vaccinated in order to best protect that population. I think it gets a little tougher when we get into all city workers. And I think it gets tougher when we start talking about vaccine mandates in workplaces where there's not, I think, such a clear line in terms of the workers interact with or the reason that they're even at their job. I think that terminating people is and costing people their livelihood over a matter of bodily autonomy it's really tough for me. I'm not an anti-vaxxer. I think that everyone should get vaccinated. I think everyone should make the choice to be vaccinated. At some point, the requirement to be vaccinated will be lifted. We don't fire people from their jobs for not getting their flu shots. We don't let people go from their place of work because they're not up to date on their measles vaccination. This is not the way our society works. So at some point, the mandate to, you know, requirements to be vaccinated, to enter public places and so forth, you got to think that they're going to be lifted at some point, and we're going to go back to, providing the best information we can and letting people make the best choice that they can. So what happens if you were let go in the fall or winter of 2021, 2022, and now there is no more vaccine mandate? What happens to you? What happens to your career? You know, and again, I think it's really important that as many people as possible are vaccinated. And a lot of people who work at the city of Windsor would fit that profile of people who have interactions with the public or people who, are engaging in close circles or close contact with people who don't really have a choice about being there. You know, they have to be in City Hall for some reason. So I understand that. And a 13-week leave is certainly a long period of time to give people to think about it. But, I think our society in general, we have a strong majority of people who support vaccination and a strong majority of people who support mandatory vaccination. But majorities don't decide human rights. And I think it's really, really important to tread carefully with stuff like this. And I hope that there was a lot of thought put in at the city about the most humane and best way to implement this, and what all of those potential far-reaching consequences of it will be.
Well, If I could quickly respond. First, I think that it was entirely done in legal and finance. And it was a matter of, you know, what's our liability and how much money are we spending on, you know, benefits to be provided to people who aren't working for their own reasons not to. As you said, 13 weeks, like three full months of just not working because you refuse to do what's now been said as part of it. And I appreciate where you're coming from with it. Yeah, there will be an end to mandates. That's absolutely true. But I was trying to put my head in the headspace of like, you know, what if I was running a business and like this had to be done? And at some point, you know, it's just, it's the dollars and cents part of it. It's just, you're refusing to do the thing that's required by the job. And I just, you know, I don't want you on the books anymore. Now, I guess it's a bit different. It's a city, but then you could have, you know, the Fred Francis's or the Eddie Francis's and the Geniacs and that group, you know, voted very hard to, you know, outsource workers, and workers' rights angle has never been a great, you know, point of defense that has been seen there. But I think it comes down to it is very tough, but what's the level of accommodation, right? Where's the accommodation that can be provided to someone whose job necessitates that they interact with the public and they refuse to?
Yep. Well, I agree. And you know, I do think those factors have to be taken into consideration, but not every single person who works for the corporation of the city of Windsor even needs to be in a defined location to do their work. So, you know, I hear you. And I just think that a blanket policy is tough, really tough.
Yeah, I think it definitely is challenging, but I also think it's challenging to make those small exceptions. Here are this pocket of people who don't, you know, engage with people. And then what do you do for people within the city who don't want to get vaccinated? And you've allowed this, you've excused a portion of the city to not have vaccines mandated because they don't necessarily engage with the public. But then what about those who don't want to be vaccinated? And do engage with the public and are also within the city. So I think also thinking as an institution, making kind of a public health policy, it makes sense to have a blanket policy versus, you know, play small negotiations here and there. I also can appreciate that's really challenging for individuals who lose their jobs. But I take what John said in terms of, you know, 13 weeks is a long period of time. And I wonder too, you know, I think I applaud big decisions and commitments that are being made. Like I applaud vaccine mandates. I applaud like strong decisions being made for public health and public safety. But I also think a challenge throughout the entire pandemic, not just within Windsor, but nationally and across the world, has been really reaching people who don't want to get vaccinated and communicating and engaging with their fears and their concerns in a compassionate and caring and understanding way. I am a caregiver to a sick parent, and I was super anxious about COVID, really excited about vaccines and, you know, really excited about vaccine mandates because I could finally go out again. I could finally take my dad out again and not be scared all the time for his health. So, you know, these things were really important decisions to me. And I too found it difficult to find sympathy for those who were scared for something that was proven to have very minimal risk and protect the lives of so many people who really could die if they caught, you know, this virus, which is not really comparable to the flu or to other illnesses at this current point in time. And still, I think that we needed to hold a space to hear people's fears and hear people's concerns and perhaps bring them in and explain why. And I think that compassionate kind of form of engaging and then providing literacy has worked. And I think at this point, it's really far gone. Like now people are so entrenched in, it's become such an identity issue of being either pro-vaccine or anti-vaccine. Whereas I think if early on we were able to compassionately reach people, perhaps it could have been done differently. So that's a little bit of nuance to add there. I also, you know, another big concern is the decrease in services, you know, when people, you know, with transit, like you named, and then, you know, people who rely on transit are now being harmed by this decision. And that's something to consider too. So I think in making these decisions, it's important to have strong contingency plan so there aren't these other casualties of the decision-making process who had no role to play, but need to get to where they need to go. So it is a touchy and difficult issue, but I still, you know, I think it's an important, I applaud anyone who's making a vaccine mandate. And I also think there needs to be compassion and understanding for people who are legitimately afraid. But I don't think that fear qualifies for protection in policy and going against public health measures.
Yeah, and I know, John, you want to move on, but I your points are really well taken, Kimia. But, you know, there's more than just fear happening here. There is also the political weaponization of vaccine hesitancy. There are organized groups who are torquing this for their own ends. I don't think for positive ends. My office faces onto Olet Avenue, so I get to hear a lot of these protests as they happen. I get to see a lot of the protests, and these are people with, to my mind, very irrational views, but these, their fears and their concerns and perhaps their sense of their own autonomy and rights as a human being have been, they're inflamed. And this is not something that I think all people who are hesitant or opposed to vaccination, this is not something that all of them arrived at independently on their own. This is something that has been stoked and inflamed, and maybe it's true that the only way that we're going to move forward is by mandates, but I think that in our haste to do so, we should recognize that this is an emergency situation. This is something that we shouldn't be relishing. This isn't something that we should be doing lightly. And the sooner that it can be over, the better. Because that, enforcing a medical procedure on people is not actually something that our society should be doing.
Nobody had it enforced on them.
Okay.
I know, and this is going to be a whole little thing right now.
Yeah. Okay.
And when we talk about, is it really a choice if it's your economic livelihood and your ability to put food on the table? And I get that. I really, really do get it. But I just get so concerned, even listening to you. I don't know if you saw the eye rolls that I had there while you were saying that. Is just like, I'm sorry, no one's getting dragged into a ghetto here and having a needle shoved into their arm. You know, everyone has the choice. Bodily autonomy is not being impacted here. It's up to what you want to do. Now, is it easy to find another job? Absolutely not.
You don't think that threatening somebody's job is coercion?
I think it, yeah.
But then you're losing
coercion's a good one. Yeah, but like coercion is a fair word to use, but it's not forced.
Okay. All right, I accept your amendment. That's fair.
And
what
sorry,
were you gonna say, Kimia? Yeah.
No. That's okay. That's good.
That's that's fair. I have many times on the show where I find myself in the middle of a sentence and I'm not able to back up and I just have to keep going with it. And so I appreciate that you just decided, let's not do that. I understand. It's, as we said at the top, it's a really tough one. It's definitely not fair. And, when you're talking about, let's say it's an inside worker, like an accountant, or even an outside worker, like a, gardener who doesn't interact with the general public, the issue becomes a lot more complicated. It's a lot more clear cut, as we said, though, when you have those interactions with the public and they don't have a choice to interact with you. But, you know, it's complicated again. You know, you have unions involved here, and the service reduction levels, they could be fixed if you could just hire someone else to drive the bus or fix the bus. And I'm not saying that I'm a union buster. Dear God, please don't start writing me letters. But I'm just saying that there are other implications that are based on this entire situation as to why it's not able to be fixed right away. Not a Pinkerton, Doug. I can read the chat. We're going to get into the Triangle Shirtwaist Company as well. It's going to be bad. We're going to go deep. Let's go on to the last topic, though, because I don't want to focus on this. We are going to have Doug pull up a video here. I will set it up for you while he does that. There was a Ward 1 meeting. Doug, you sat in on it on Zoom.
I did. Yeah.
That's your ward, right?
It definitely is my ward. Yeah.
Big curling guy you are. We know that.
I'm not, but people I care about are.
There you go. That's fair. You use the clubhouse, though. You've said on the show that you hold meetings there sometimes. It's a place that you go to.
Yes. Yes. And I golf there.
So, there's the disclosure, folks. Now you see where it's coming from. Ward 1's counselor, Fred Francis, says that Roseland is cash flow positive with revenues that the best they've been in 15 years. Let's take a listen to him.
The question is, what's going on at Roseland? Thank you for the question. It goes text to me. And we are working right now. I am chair of the board at Roseland. Well, let me report first that last year was a very profitable year for Roseland. We made just under 300,000. And I can let you all know, kind of breaking news right now, at the end of October, we are double that figure. So last year we made just under 300,000. And month ending October, we are double that figure as a profit margin. Now we still have November and December, so obviously 600,000 might not be the final number, but this year stands to be a very profitable year at Roseland and about a 10 to 15 year high potentially with 2 months to go. So financial.
Wild. 10 to 15 year high. I swear to gosh, I keep watching the news and it says inflation's going up, business is bad, things aren't going well, but Roseland,
highly profitable.
Best year in 15 years. Kudos. And that doesn't even include the last 2 months. You know, you could still go play golf right now. And then curling season, I presume, is starting as it's getting colder. Now, we've had Darcy Reno on the show. She ran against Fred Francis in the last election. She posted to social media that Roseland received a substantial infusion of cash from city allocated federal COVID relief funds. Doug, you watched this. You saw it all unfold live. It's your ward. You've got the better insider track on this specifically from your vantage point. What's your take on this one that, you know, we've had this allocation of funds towards Roseland to be able to propel them into this position, best in 15 years. And what is this? I'm sorry, what? We're just, 5 months after approving, $5 million for a new clubhouse or something like that?
Yeah, so I think that Mayor Francis, this is Councillor Francis, not Mayor Francis. Councillor Francis is concerned about Roseland being a liability for him in the upcoming municipal election. You may remember over the summer, Darcy Reno wrote an op-ed piece in the Windsor Star about Roseland and about, I'm not sure that she used the word, but what I would characterize as mismanagement at Roseland over the years. And so you can understand why Councillor Francis would be eager to talk about a bit of financial success, but and we don't have the figures for 2021 because of course that year is not closed. Darcy has access to the financial statements for Roseland for this year. I had a chance to see a copy, and she's quite correct. There is over $400,000 of COVID relief funds that were funneled into Roseland, and that was not the entire entirety of the profit. You know, there were some losses made up and then a whole bunch of profit, but there, that would not have been a profitable operation if it had not been for COVID relief funding. So I think it was a big mistake for Councillor Francis to talk about record profits at Roseland without providing that context. This is not caused by his business acumen as chair. It's not caused by any particular decisions of management. It's basically been caused by the injection of cash to the municipality. And I'd be curious to know how those funds were allocated to the arm's length corporations and boards and committees and so forth of the city. Was there a formula that, you know, this organization, the tunnel gets this much and Roseland gets that much? How were these funds allocated? I think that's a really interesting question. But I think it was, in the specific context of the ward meeting, I think it was Councillor Francis being so eager to cover up an existing vulnerability that he perhaps uncovered a new one, because this is not something that, you know, you should be taking credit for.
There's nothing here to brag about taking COVID relief funds and, you know, funneling it into the golf and curling club. Listen, I don't want to say all departments, but, you know, a lot of our departments and entities suffered setbacks. But, you know, you keep hearing about how the city needs increased funding because we've lost out on tunnel money and we've lost out on casino money and whatnot. And you wonder, I guess Roseland continues to be a priority for the city.
Yep.
That's the awkward silence. We could just,
Well, there's no question. Roseland is a strangely outsized priority, but not so strange, you know, going back to the semi-cynical conversation we had earlier about who votes in this town and who matters in this town. If you look at voter turnout by voting subdivision, not just by ward, the Roseland area is one of the highest turnout areas in the city. It's you know, the top two or three voting subdivisions in the city. So Roseland matters. Roseland matters for electing a Ward 1 councillor. Roseland matters for electing a mayor. And that's why Roseland gets all this attention.
Well, and it's a historical golf course, right? I was talking to my dad about this beforehand, and he goes, it's a legit golf course. It's a famous designer. There aren't many of his courses remaining, I guess.
Yes, that's true. Golf. And I think you can have the argument about whether or not that's an amenity that a municipality should own. I happen to think that municipal golf courses are not a bad thing at all. I'm not sure Roseland fits my criteria for what makes a good municipal golf course. I actually think Little River is a pretty exemplary municipal golf course. It's a cheap, easy course in the heart of the city, easily accessible by transit. And I think it makes the sport more accessible to city residents. And I think that that's good. I'm not sure Roseland really fits those criteria, but it's a sacred cow in that part of the city. It is something that people really value. It's a reason why people have their homes there. People would believe that it has a positive impact on property values and so on and so forth. So it's not surprising that we funnel outsized resources towards this particular municipal asset.
Does Roseland employ a lot of people?
Define a lot. A golf course is a pretty significant operation. I don't have numbers in front of me, but I would guess there's at least a few dozen people employed there.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know. This is my bias, is that I've never been to a golf course. I hold the idea of a golf course in my head that it's generally upper middle class or wealthy people who occupy, you know, and spend time at a golf course. And so it's really hard for me to accept that Windsor is a city that struggles so much with poverty, with, you know, homelessness, with you know, we, a few years ago, I don't know if this is still true, but a few years ago, we had the one of the highest child poverty rates in the city. And it's really hard to swallow that we're spending so much money on a golf course. And I don't want to, you know, especially during a pandemic, I don't know if I'm, if this is a hot take or a radical take. But, you know, as someone who doesn't use amenities like this and doesn't really know, you know, as a young racialized person, I don't really have any friends who go to the golf course either. Just who is this funding serving? And that's, I was at the Ward 1 meeting too. I live in Ward 1 actually. And it was hard in the context of all the problems that are happening in the world, in the context of the climate crisis, in the context of the pandemic. I was like, you know, it was hard for me to accept. We're talking about a golf, we're talking about tennis courts, we're talking, it just really feels like all of our like Ward 1 privileged issues are consuming us when we actually live in a city that has legitimate challenges and issues. And I wish, you know, that was a bit hard for me as someone who focuses on equity and thinks about these issues and lives in Ward 1 and in a wealthy community. So I don't know.
Yeah. None of what I heard or saw at the ward meeting surprised me in the slightest. You mentioned a couple of the big hits. The other one that I think we should mention is the pretty intense opposition to the multi-residential condo development on North Talbot Road across from Southwood Lakes. There were some pretty angry people there, essentially. You know, arguing that there is no place in that part of the city for that kind of dense housing. So, yeah, it was a moderately rage-inducing ward meeting, but it's nothing that surprised me from my fellow Ward 1 residents.
Yeah,
Ward 1 is full.
None of my questions were asked. I sent a slew of questions and not a single one was addressed.
Okay, I'm so glad you brought that up. I because you're not the only person. I pretty seriously slated the telephone town halls that were held in place of ward meetings last year. They were terrible, absolutely terrible. This Zoom ward meeting was a vast improvement on those telephone town halls. So I'm glad that the city did it this way, but it's still a far cry from what you get at a live in-person ward meeting. And the biggest thing is the control of the questions. I saw somebody else on social media shared an extensive list of questions that they asked at the Ward 1 meeting. Some good, some less good, doesn't matter. None of those questions were asked. you know, it's really disappointing to hear also from you, Kimia, that this is the case, that, you know, this is, it's not just an isolated incident with one person who maybe they didn't feel like taking questions from. The questions were selected that in order to give Fred Francis the opportunity to showcase what he thought the residents who vote for him want to hear, rather than answering tough questions from residents, which to me is what these ward meetings are really all about.
Yeah. If I saw a list of questions coming from someone in the audience, you're absolutely not getting any of them through. You're clearly causing problems. Joking aside, it is really unfair though, the way that it's set up. If it was a real ward meeting in person, what typically happens is if there's a list or a lineup of people, the candidate or the ward counselor will answer the questions and go through it. And, yep. You know, people will disperse and it might go an extra 15, 20 minutes, but you really don't want to get into a shouting match with a constituent in front of media because you didn't answer a question. But the control that's over this format, there's a lot to be said about the accessibility and transparency that's been provided in the new Zoom era of engagement, but there are still significant shortfalls. And I think that level of micromanaging is absolutely one of them. But we're running late. We have to move on right now to for your consideration. Doug, let's have you go first.
Sure thing. So I want to bring everyone's attention to something that was on page 135 of your city council agenda this past week, and that is the introduction of a video surveillance policy for the city of Windsor. So a couple things here. There is a policy document that I encourage you read. There is also a good background information there from the Privacy Commissioner of Ontario. So there's a lot of good material to read, as well as a policy which was unanimously adopted as this report came in on consent. So I encourage you to take a look at it. It's all very interesting. How the hell did we get to 2021 before we had a policy for how we were going to deal with the privacy issues associated with the 700 surveillance cameras that the city operates? Just wild, absolutely wild for your consideration.
Not surprised that privacy considerations wasn't at the top of the list. That might be a four-year consideration that I bring up in the future, some privacy violations that the city may or may not have committed. Just a bit of a teaser there, completely nice. Out of context. It's perfect. Kenia, let's bring you in next. Do you have a four-year consideration? I'm told you do.
I do indeed. And I have been consumed the past few days, as I mentioned, by the flooding happening in British Columbia. Cities and communities are being evacuated. Entire cities are underwater. Highways that lead into the province are completely cut off. It's a really, really scary situation. In Abbotsford, where there's a significant amount of flooding, there's now a parking lot of parked RVs that are also on fire. So not only have people fled from floods, but now they're being told to keep their windows and doors closed because of the fumes from fires. And so it's a really scary situation. And I'd encourage folks to go and look for mutual aid opportunities to support people out in British Columbia, and also to think about how in your community, in your workplace, in whatever kind of structure or system you're a part of, you can try and advance climate action, because, you know, it's hard individually, but if you're part of a school, if you're part of an industry, there are ways that we can do this. So that is for your consideration.
You know, it's a good one. I mean, it's hard to say there isn't climate change when you look at Abbotsford specifically experienced its hottest year ever on record, what, just 140 days ago, and then experienced its wettest day on record. I saw another graph of, or a map of climate emergencies in British Columbia, and it included 700 who died in the heat dome. It included the wildfires. It's including the flooding. There was a tornado at UBC. The Port of Vancouver right now, this is the one that blows me away. Vancouver is entirely separated from rail and land access to the rest of Canada right now. The only way you can access Canada is by going into the United States and driving through. So, I mean, it's, you think that COVID was the biggest shakeup that we've had, and it's just like Mother Nature saying, hold my beer. I'm going to show you how things actually can get. Staggering, terrifying. And yeah, no, if you, I agree. Donate, mutual aid, provide some help. People need it. Thank you for that one, Kenia. Finally, I've got one. City Council's moving to 4 p.m. There was a staff report that had suggested moving it to 1 p.m. And the agreed upon middle ground was 4 p.m. as a result of the fact that city councilors work, about half of them actually do. They have jobs, and it is really an equity issue when you think about it. We're paying our councilors part-time, and that means that they have to work, make money, do the thing, or they don't, and they're retired, and they've got enough largesse that they're able to live off of what they've already done, which, you know, really creates a divide in what type of counselor do you want? Do you want a counselor who's full-time, or do you want a counselor that's part-time but works their ass off? And to me, it's an interesting middle ground right now that we've decided on the 4 p.m. because I think that it will prompt a very real conversation. I know that there is a report that is going to administration is going to be compiling, that's going to be going to council, that's going to be looking at counselor pay. And I think that it's actually a conversation that we need to start having because we haven't had one for a very long time. Counselor pay is inadequate, quite frankly. Counselor expenses are non-existent. They get a $2,000 technology grant once per year. That doesn't cover even software. It's just, here's $2,000 that you get to spend. And then there's ward funds that are, you know, sometimes allocated equitably and sometimes not so equitably and sometimes not at all, depending if it's the enhanced capital budget and how that plays out. But the point being is that, you know, do you want a counselor that's full time? Do you want a counselor who's actually working in your interests fully? The budget of the city on an annual basis is almost $1 billion. This is a $1 billion corporation. These, like, if this was in the private sector, there would definitely be like a Cessna or a Challenger jet that was involved in terms of what the compensation package included. But here in Windsor, it's like $45,000, which, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. But I mean, I would like a full-time counselor. I think a lot of people would like a full-time counselor. And to even though have these conversations is a bit of a poison pill that we saw during the Francis years of pulling everything back, cost cutting, the reductions, and now to bring it up for any counselors to bring it up publicly, quite frankly, it's, as I said, poison pill. So for your considerations, let's pay our counselors more and like, let's get the best that we can out of the city. It's a $1 billion budget a year. Like, don't you want full-time eyes on it for your consideration? So that's it. That's the show. Kenia, you've been great. Thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you. I've had fun. It's been good to be here.
Yeah, this has been a really enjoyable conversation. I know that Doug would agree with me. He's nodding his head furiously in agreement. He, though, unfortunately, has had a robotic takeover right now. He is fending off his Roomba, which, oh my God, Doug has been dragged off screen. It's horrific. The blood is streaming upwards. But this has been, it's been such a fun show. Kenia, thank you for your input. You're going to be coming back on. I don't think you get a choice in that one. There isn't much of this is the consultation checkbox of I'm requesting that you'll be on, but we know that you'll be back at some point. So thank you so much for joining us. This has been Rose City Politics. It is November 17th. Our regular panel tonight included myself, John Lidke, and Doug Sartori. We had Kenia Razagian on as well as our guest host. If you are a fan, head over to patreon.com/Rose City Politics and give us a boost. We are in BizX Magazine at bizxmagazine.com and on all of your favorite podcast and social media apps. And Rose City Politics has been able to broadcast live on tape thanks to the kind support of Leuna625, building better communities. We will be back next week because that is our commitment to you. Every week, we follow the news so you don't have to. We will see you then.